Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Daily Tech News Show is made possible by its listeners. Thanks to all of you, including Kevin, Paul Thiessen, and Ali Sanjabi. Coming up on DTNS, how well can smartwatches detect heart issues? Twitter theatrics continue, whether we like them or not. And Patrick Norton is here with home theater gift guides. This is the Daily Tech News for Friday, November 18th, 2022. From Studio Redwood, I'm Sarah Lane.
From somewhere in St. Louis, I'm Patrick Norton.
Drawing the top tech stories in Cleveland, I'm Len Peralta.
And I'm the show's producer, Roger Chang.
Well, we do have quite a show for y'all. We're going to talk about gift guides. We're going to talk about Twitter melting down. But first, let's start with the quick hits. The U.S. Federal Communications Commission introduced new rules requiring internet service providers to display easy-to-read labels with key facts about products at the point of sale. They look like nutrition labels and should include base price, itemized additional fees, speed, and any data allowances. Also, the Indian Space Research Organization successfully launched the country's first privately developed vehicle, the Vikram-S, suborbital rocket developed by Skyroot Aerospace. Skyroot developed the 6-meter-long rocket over the last 2 years, and it carried payloads for 3 customers.
Nice.
Bloomberg sources say that the U.S. government continues to seek information on agreements Elon Musk may have made with foreign investors who hold stakes in Twitter after his acquisition of the company, specifically around access to user data. Earlier this week, the U.S. Treasury Department, which leads the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., said it saw no need for such an investigation. We will be talking about Twitter a little later in the show. But first, Japan's Fuji News Network reports authorities arrested Sonic the Hedgehog's co-creator, Nuji Naka, on insider trading charges. The charges involve Naka allegedly buying 10,000 shares on the developer network Aimlean prior to the public announcement of the Dragon Quest Tact mobile game it was jointly developing with Square Enix. Raised some eyebrows, obviously. Naka previously worked with Square Enix between 2018 and 2021. Samsung added support for Latin American Spanish to its Bixby virtual assistant. Some of you are using Bixby, so you're probably going to be excited about that. Samsung said that the Galaxy S22 and S21 lineups, as well as the Z Fold 4 and Z Flip 4, get support now, with more older devices getting support coming in December. Brazilian Portuguese was the only Latin American language supported by Bixby until now. All right, Patrick, let's talk about hearts, shall we?
I have a lot of heart.
Me too.
Almighty.
And who shouldn't? A new study from the Mayo Clinic focused on whether or not the Apple Watch's ECG feature can detect heart abnormalities, such as left ventricular dysfunction. If you're not familiar with that, an ECG monitor measures and records your heart rate and its rhythm and displays that information in a wave-like pattern that you can either use for yourself, share with your doctor, etc. However, certain abnormalities are often undiagnosed because they don't show symptoms, but they can be followed by very serious medical issues like congestive heart failure. Nobody wants that. So, looking at 2,454 patients across 12 countries and including 124,000 ECGs from Apple Watch data between August 2021 and February of this year, the researchers' findings indicate that consumer watch ECGs acquired in non-clinical environments can indeed identify patients with cardiac dysfunction or who might have that in the future. An AI algorithm used in the study is currently being reviewed by the FDA, so that's not happening yet, but it is in review. But the full study results and discoveries were published in Nature Medicine this week, which will be in our show notes. I thought this was pretty fascinating. I mean, I wear an Apple Watch. I'm not totally worried about heart stuff. Patrick, worried about lots of other things. But what do you make of this?
So I look at this and I think two things. One, this is amazing, you know, because there's been all sorts of heart issues in various branches of my family and people I've known and all that kind of stuff. And on the other hand, I'm like, oh, this is going to send a whole nother flood of people trying to figure out if they have, you know, what they have and searching maybe not the best vetted websites for medical information. And I, you know, I'm fascinated. I'm curious, you know, cause this is really kind of like tricorder zone where it's like, I have a handheld device that will allow me to run an electrocardiogram. This used to take, you know, hours in a hospital and blah, 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 or, you know, a doctor's office. And so it's really slick. But that there's a really, you know, thin or maybe a really wide but kind of amorphous line between this is a medical product that has been certified by medical professionals and testing, and we made a thing that acts like that other thing that requires a doctor, and you can do this at home. So I'm really, really curious to see. I haven't had a chance to play around with one of these yet. It might be horrifying. It might cause me to immediately go to a doctor. But I'm very, 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 very curious to see what, you know, what the kind of studies say about this over the next few years as they kind of examine how these work, how well they work in the real world. You know, does it save lives? Does it just cause all sorts of people panicking and going to the doctor? I'm curious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that good point. I'm with you. I am one of those people who will go to WebMD. You know, anytime I'm like, my left arm feels weirdly numb. Am I dying? Kind of thing. And yeah, there's a lot of misinformation out there, and not necessarily nefarious, but just information that is not helpful to you as a person who really needs to go to a medical professional. That said, for folks who are wearing not only an Apple Watch, there are certainly a variety of other handheld devices that do ECG or EKG functionalities, that it feels to me like, you know, even if I were to get like a alert, like, you know, you might want to see your doctor.
Right.
Maybe there's nothing to it. Maybe there is something more to it. But the fact that the study showed that, well, it was definitely picking up on things that other people were going to have problems with down the road. Hard to say no.
No, like hundreds of thousands of people, like I think, you know, several hundred thousand people die every year from heart-related disease or heart disease. So anything that helps slow that down, like, oh, here's a fantastic CDC.gov stat. Every year, about 805,000 people in the United States have a heart attack. So, you know, let's anything that makes it better or easier for people to find out they have a problem before it turns into a heart attack, I got to say that's a good thing.
Yeah, me too. Me too. All right. Well, let's talk about things we might want to buy for the holiday season. On Monday, we talked to Trisha Hirschberger about gift shopping for gamers this holiday season. What does the gamer that you love in your life want as a gift. But what do you get that special somebody, you know, could be your adversary, I don't know, who wants the best audio from a home theater setup or just a great way to listen to their music? Patrick, you deal with this stuff all the time on AVXL. That's what you and Robert Aaron do best. So what are your gift recommendations for these folks?
Oh, my goodness. So my partner in AVXL Home Audio Theater Mayhem, or Home Theater Mayhem, Robert Heron, he's going to be on next week, I think Monday, to talk about best deals on TVs. So we laugh, like, you know, 50% of home theater is video and 50% of home theater is audio. And all too many people experience home theater. I might even say 90% of some movies and television shows is audio. I am probably exaggerating because I like the speakers and the headphones, but audio is a huge part, especially in the age of Dolby Atmos. Audio is a huge part of the experience. And if you don't have a decent set of speakers, you're missing out on some really spectacular work by some really creative people. Yes, your TV probably has speakers and they probably suck. I mean, sound comes out of them. You can figure out what people are saying. There's kind of a thing that might sound like an explosion, but I am mocking them. But generally speaking, speakers are kind of an afterthought. They are stuffed in the space that is left over from the rest of the engineering. And moving up to a simple soundbar or a decent set of stereo speakers will be a big step up for almost every television out there. Or you can go for the ultimate, which is a full surround sound system. You know, it can, you don't have to spend a lot of money.
And when you say surround sound, you're talking about like 5.1?
Yeah, like a center channel, a left and right speaker, rear channels, if you really want to do it up, Dolby elevation speakers or Dolby overhead speakers. But, you know, if you don't want to spend a lot of money or you don't want to get complicated, just recycle a set of computer speakers or garage sale speakers and amp. Klipsch Pro Media 2.1, these speakers have been around forever. They sound decent. They're $150. You know, if you can figure out a way to get the audio from your television into these speakers, they will probably be a major upgrade from the speakers inside of the television, right? Soundbars have gotten incredibly sophisticated. I've been amazed when an entry-level Vizio soundbar, they cost under $200 for the entry-level ones, and they do a very good job of bringing you the sound experience. And soundbars are also, when I say sophisticated, there are a lot of soundbars that are doing, you know, Dolby Atmos. They are doing legit Dolby Atmos with upfiring speakers. They are sort of synthesizing Dolby Atmos through processing to give you a larger soundstage or more impressive soundstage. You know, something like Vizio's M512A, it's a soundbar. It has real channels. It has a sub. It's not a sub like it's going to shake your house, but it's a sub like you're going to feel the, you know, the music down to 40 or 50 hertz, and it's going to be impressive, and it's got up-firing Atmos speakers. It's like $400 or $500. That is going to be an amazing upgrade from the speakers that are in your television. The folks at Wirecutter, they have really good things to say about JBL's Bar 2.1 Deep Bass. I haven't had a chance to hear that. It doesn't have real channels, but it is going to give you a good front sound stage and really solid low end.
But on the subject of soundbars, sure. I had a friend who knew that we were going to be talking about this today and is kind of putting together their new apartment and was like, is Sonos still the soundbar to get? And I was like, well, I mean, it's an expensive soundbar to get, but it sounds like Sonos has a lot of competition now.
There is a lot of competition, right? So Sonos is not inexpensive. By the time you get a soundbar and a couple of, you know, Play One type speakers for the back, I shouldn't call them Play Ones, or some of my favorites, these sort of panel speakers, that there's a IKEA Sonos Symphonisk speaker that's essentially a picture speaker that's incredibly friendly for wall mounting and actually sounds shockingly good. Sonos, I would buy Sonos if I was invested in the Sonos environment. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, probably 8 Sonos, you know, kind of friendly streaming devices in our house, right? Because that's what's in the boys' bedrooms. We have the IKEA lamps. We have a couple of the speakers in the living room, the dining room, the kitchen, the bedroom. And I have the ability to run the stuff through an amp and a set of speakers downstairs. For us, Sonos, it was amazing because I set up the Sonos system and I got our MP3 collection hooked up to it. Then I got Spotify hooked up to it, and it changed the way everybody in my family listened to music in a really positive way because it made it easy to stream music anywhere at the house of a pretty good quality. The soundbars are actually really good. Robert Heron uses a Sonos soundbar in his house and he is in love with it. They have an optional subwoofer you can add on to that. They just came out with a sub mini recently that is actually pretty good. The big sub's a little boomy, but if you want movies or you love the booty shaking bass lines, it is a delightful.
If you don't have downstairs neighbors.
Yeah, that's a big one, downstairs neighbors. But it's kind of amazing. If you go with the Beam or the Arc and a couple of Sonos One speakers for the surround sounds, it is really nice. It's a little more spendy than a lot of them, you know, and it's a toss up. If you're in the Sonos environment, I'd say absolutely get a Sonos soundbar. If you're not in the Sonos environment and you start getting that $800 to $1,200 range, I start being like, spend a little bit more and start thinking about separate speakers and an AV receiver. It's Brent Butterworth, a writer, audio reviewer, writer, bass player, actually jazz bass player, fantastic human being. I really like his work. He did a really nice set of testing with what I will affectionately call not stupid, crazy home theater geeks like me, titled "Can a Good Soundbar Rival a True Surround Sound System in a Blind Listening Test?" Go to the Wirecutter, read that article, because it talks about what happens when you go from a soundbar, which is a block of speakers in a box mounted under or over your television set, versus having a distinct and separate and hopefully, you know, appropriately spaced out left speaker, right speaker, and center channel. And center channel being separate from the left and right speakers really open up the sound stage or the experience in some really cool ways, especially if you have rear surround sounds there. You know, I think a great place to start is ELAC's debut 2.0 speakers and center channel paired, basically entry-level 5.1 4K ready AV receiver, Denon's AVR S540BT. Great place to start for 5.1 surround sound. You know, once you have that 5.1, the three front channels, the two rear channels, the next thing, and a subwoofer, the next thing to think about is overhead speakers, or what they call, you know, Dolby Atmos elevation speakers, where they're up-firing speakers. And if you want to talk about that, do me a favor, email ask@avxl.com, because Sarah and I don't have enough time to get into all the delightful things to consider. But Atmos in a well-installed room, like Atmos, Dolby Atmos, is amazing. Like, I don't care about the 6th, the 7th, the 9th, and the 11th speakers in a surround sound system, but if you, instead of adding more speakers around you, you do those speakers above you or up firing, it's a pretty amazing experience when it's set up properly.
Real quick, for anybody who says, well, you know, I'm interested in building out my home theater, but I'm also really interested in the best headphones. I know I have my thoughts, but real quick, what would you point people towards?
Oh my goodness. I have a list in the rundown. Cut me off at any time.
Yes, it'll be in our show notes. There's a lot of information here.
I have too many. I love headphones, right? So you got $20 for $17 monoprices, premium hi-fi DJ style over-the-ear pro headphones. I'm pretty sure Roger Chang is wearing a set of these right now. If not, I'd bet money he's wearing a pair of Sony's MDR7506s. That is a fantastic headphone. I've owned them for years and years and years. That's Wirecutter's best headphone under $100. I'm also a big fan of Beyerdynamics DT770. Some people call them ugly. I call them wonderful. They're bulletproof. You know, they are a studio staple for professional studios. They're $140 on Amazon right now. They are fantastic. If you want to start getting into sort of audiophile stuff, Monolith's Monoprice M565C. They are a closed back, which means, you know, it keeps the sound inside the headphone, over ear, planar magnetic. Planar magnetic is basically a thin strip of material that they run electricity through, you know, strips of metal that are bonded to the thin material. They start doing really spectacular things, especially with music that has a lot of high end or cymbals and orchestral music. Can I keep going, or should we just point people to the website? Because I got more.
I know you do. I wish we did have more. What Patrick has given us is quite a few links. So if anything has tickled your fancy in any of the conversations that we had over the last few minutes, do check out our show notes, because there's a lot of information here. And I think the takeaway is one size doesn't fit all. It might be that, you know, you're on a budget. It might be that you want the best audio.
Yeah.
Well, it might be that, you know, there's a comfort fit, you know, that appeals to you.
I got a list of the best kind of neutral, fairly comfortable headphones from $20 up to like a $900 set of Dan Clark Audio Aeon 2s, and even something more expensive than that if you're really feeling unhinged. So go forth,
Go forth.
Make the music sound better.
Well, as you do go forth, Patrick, Twitter, where do we begin with week that was Twitter? We have covered Twitter, and there are days that we haven't covered Twitter on DTNS because it seemed more businessy than tech. But here we are. So let's just run it down. We'll start with The Verge's coverage that earlier this week, Twitter owner Elon Musk fired dozens of employees who criticized or mocked him in tweets and internal messages. This is coming from the employees. Then he set a deadline of 5 p.m. Eastern time on Thursday. That would be yesterday for anybody who's listening live, for all employees to either respond yes on a Google form that they wanted to stay for what he's calling Twitter 2.0 or not. Otherwise, leave the company, receive a severance package.
He was like, we're going to be hardcore and making Twitter 2.0 and we're going to live in the office and we're going to eat flat foods, sit under our doors. And I'm exaggerating, but not by a lot. And basically commit to this by signing up in the Google form. Or if you don't, we're going to give you 3 months severance. And the rumors that are showing up in some fairly major sites is that something like 1,200 people out of the 3,750-ish left
who were remaining
layoffs were like, bye. Yeah.
Very much, yes.
Yeah.
Many of those folks are talking to various publications who are taking stock of this.
Yeah, and they locked all the employees out until Monday.
Right. That was something that Bloomberg reported, that Musk on some level, reverse this whole no more working from home policy, which, you know, a lot of people were like, are you kidding? Look at all the Twitter employees across the world. We all have to go into an office. Well, there are fewer of them now. But an email that was sent today, quote, regarding remote work, all that is required for approval is that your manager takes responsibility for ensuring that you are making an excellent contribution. It's also expected that you have in-person meetings with your colleagues on a reasonable cadence, ideally weekly, but not less than once per month. At risk of stating the obvious, any manager who falsely claims that somebody reporting to them is doing excellent work or that a given role is essential, whether remote or not, will be exited from the company.
That seems like the kind of thing you shouldn't
have. I mean, Patrick, I think you and I have had some crappy bosses in the past, but this is taking a cake
of
some kind.
I was – okay, so we've both been through a WARN Act firing, right, which kind of comes down to 60 days notice or 60 days pay, to grossly oversimplify. It's a longer period of time in New York. It is a thing. The whole process of this has just been so brutal and so unpleasant, and the reaction has been pretty harsh, in the Twitterverse, and actually the reaction, not to get businessy, but the reaction to the Tesla stock, because I feel like a lot of Tesla investors are like, shouldn't you be making cars instead of tanking Twitter? What people are saying is that they've lost so many, you know, they literally had days. It is not a particular exaggeration to say they had not that many hours to put together the list of people they were cutting out of an incredibly large group of people. And I get it. You want to do staff reductions. You have to change things. You've got, you know, $1 billion a year in debt, you know, payments to make. You've just spent $44 billion for a company that's never actually really made money. I can get where you would be like, we're going to cut expenses right now. I feel like they're in a position where they slashed a lot of people, and then they did a lot of things that were really unpleasant or unkind to a lot of critical employees who may, even despite the cooling down of tech employment in the Bay Area, have options. And now they're looking around, and probably the speculation is, you know, this is a complicated code base that, you know, according to people who are being quoted in relatively legit publications, requires a lot of maintenance to keep it functioning.
Indeed.
And that's, you know, that's the big question. Will Twitter stay up? Will Twitter collapse? You know, will Elon have a fit of pique and shut it down?
Well, and you know, if you, I don't know, if you hang out on Twitter as much as I do, you know, as of last night, 9 p.m. Pacific time, before I just, you know, shut my computer off and said no more for me, it sounded like, oh well, we'll see if this whole platform even stands tomorrow.
Right.
It is standing. It is. But one of the most recent notes comes from the New York Times. This was pretty soon before we started the show. Sources from the NYT saying that internal estimates show that about 1,200 full-time Twitter employees resigned on Thursday. This is in reaction to Elon Musk saying, are you in Twitter 2.0 or are you out? Twitter had about, you know, 37 staff after the mass layoff. So if you're kind of going, all right, so of the 3,700, if 1,200, and, you know, there's probably some leeway on those numbers, have walked away, we are getting into weird territory.
Yeah.
We're getting into weird territory here. And, yeah.
Yeah. I just want to say good luck. I hope everybody who has been, you know, booted from Twitter or has chosen to exit at Twitter is well taken care of and has good options. Because that, you know, again, Sarah and I have been through it a whole bunch of times. It's never fun. Mm-hmm. So, you know, good luck. And hey, hopefully the remaining engineering staff, you know, maybe hopefully the code base is more robust than people are implying and the remaining staff is able to keep it going. And who knows what it's going to be? Because, yeah, I don't even want to mention things involving, you know, little blue check marks and impersonations and all that other mayhem.
I mean, we could be here all day. Truly.
All week.
All day, all week, all month. I don't want to be here all year. But if you are feeling social, we do still have a Twitter account, which we use, DTNS Show on Twitter. We're also on TikTok at Daily Tech News Show and DTNS Pix, P-I-X, on Instagram.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence, Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed, and Haiku is the fastest and lowest-cost model in the market, perfectly designed for high-volume, high-speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
All right, let's hand it off to our very own Tom Merritt now for a deep dive into accessibility in video games.
Pretty much everybody likes playing video games, right? But not everybody can use the stock controllers on offer. Thankfully, video game accessibility is getting a lot more attention these days. And Steve Saylor is leading that push as a video game accessibility consultant who's worked with developers like Naughty Dog and Microsoft. Steve, welcome to DTNS.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what are some of the common issues that video accessibility can address?
A lot of it mostly comes down to just trying to be able to break down the barriers that disabled players have to basically go through on a day-to-day basis and still keep in the same challenge that a video game provides. I mean, otherwise it basically just be like watching a movie. So a lot of times people with who are deaf and hard of hearing, blind, low vision, those with motor disabilities, or even those with cognitive disabilities, what we try to be able to do is basically make it so that some of those disabilities that or barriers that they have in everyday life essentially can be able to be removed, and whether that's through design or through options in whatever game they want to play.
So how do you approach that from the developer side? What kind of things do you need to do?
There's several things you can do. As a lot of it comes down to education, because not every developer either knows someone that has a disability or just knows what to specifically do. Sure, so there are guidelines and resources that are provided online, that are freely available, and also some that are, paid, that essentially you can be able to tap into to learn more about it. It's also being able to talk to consultants like myself that have a disability, that live it day to day, that they can be able to offer suggestions and feedback that developers may not understand or know or about. And then essentially it's about basically starting it from the very beginning. As many times as developers, as you start a project, you have the ability built to have also almost unlimited budget, unlimited resources. And the earlier you can start with accessibility, and you design with everyone in mind, then essentially it makes it a lot easier down the road to be able to either tweak or to be able to get feedback and be able to make a more whole accessible experience.
Yeah, that makes sense. Get in early, right? So that you're budgeted in from the beginning and you're not trying to add something on at the end. On the other side, on the infrastructure side, I think a lot of people who are unfamiliar with accessibility look at a game controller. In fact, some people forget accessibility, look at a game controller and go, that's a lot of buttons. How do I take advantage of that? How do you translate things like thumbsticks and D-pads and all of that sort of thing?
Well, it depends, because sometimes there are definitely players that can't even use a controller in sort of the common, whether it's like a DualSense controller from PlayStation or an Xbox controller on the Series X or even Nintendo. And it's kind of evolved mostly just from how we used to have controllers in the 80s and hasn't really evolved in regards to accessibility. So a lot of times it really kind of comes down to being able to provide freedom and customization that if you need to be able to play with a controller that either vertically instead of horizontally, or play with one-handed, or to be able to utilize essentially what hardware like what Xbox has, which is the Xbox Adaptive Controller, which provides like you can set up buttons and switches and toggles that those with motor disabilities can essentially be able to use, and then having other people to be able to kind of play with you, kind of using systems called Copilot, where essentially you can kind of combine multiple controllers into one controller and allows more people to be able to kind of play at the same time if there are certain controls that a disabled player can't be able to utilize or be able to kind of fully use.
It seems like you'd have to make sure that inputs on the designer end are standardized then, so that depending on what system is being used, it's still going to translate into the game. Is there an industry standard on that sort of thing?
Not currently. And that's something that we in the disabled, or at least in the accessibility community, we don't necessarily try to encourage, because if there is like a sort of a standard set of like, here's all the options you should have, then it just becomes a checklist, and people and developers may not want to be able to just move past that checklist. And because everyone wants to be able to make their game as different as possible, that to kind of stand out from the crowd, every game is different, and every game also provides new challenges for disabled players.
Sure,
so
sure.
There are sort of a certain standard, like stuff like offering subtitle options and customization for controls, or having a large text size. Like that stuff can be kind of universal for the most part, but we always try to encourage that it's not necessarily about what standard options that you can have into a game, but it's more about trying to design an accessible experience.
Got it. I know we have some small or sometimes beginning game developers in the audience. I think for them, it's like, well, it's easy for Naughty Dog to do this. They've got tons of resources. How does a small, maybe independent solo game developer address accessibility themselves?
Actually, it's a really great question, because kind of the common myth is that if you're an independent developer and you don't have a lot of money to provide for budget or resources, that accessibility is difficult to do. But in reality, you can actually be able to do a lot more for accessibility than a AAA can. Like AAA, you have managers, you have a lot of red tape that you would have to go through just to get any approval on trying to be able to try out a new thing, whereas an indie developer, there's less red tape. So essentially, they can just kind of go in, try a bunch of different things, and it would make them a lot more efficient in trying to be able to make things more accessible. Plus, also, there are free resources. Like, there is a video game accessibility guidelines that you can be able to search up on Google. Xbox provides them as well. And there actually are testing services that Xbox provides at any given point in the development process that is specifically for independent developers that, hey, we just want to make sure that your game is accessible. We'll test it, we'll help you out, we'll provide guidelines, and all of that is either up to like from free, or you can be able to pay Xbox even to be able to have that kind of access to their service.
Ah, fantastic. Steve, thank you so much for sharing your insights and expertise on this. If folks want to follow more of what you do, where should they go?
Yeah, you can be able to follow me on Twitter at Steve Saylor, or twitch.tv/blindgamersteve, or on my YouTube channel, where I do a lot of accessibility reviews and previews, youtube.com/snowball.
Well, going on with the thank yous, because we have a lot of people who contributed to the show today. We'd like to thank Len Peralta. Len, so nice to see you again. What have you been drawing for us?
Well, you know, next week here in the United States, it's the Thanksgiving holiday. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we ended up talking a little about Twitter, and that's I sort of did a mashup of Thanksgiving and Twitter. This one's called Is the Bird Done? And
oh, goodness.
After last night's meltdown, I'm not really sure
going. Like arugula under the bird?
It's like, or lettuce, possibly. Yeah, I don't know. Something. It's asparagus, you know, all kinds of good stuff.
It's, you know, but, whatever you make of it.
Yeah, so for all those exited Twitter employees, if you'd like to order this, if you're a Patreon of mine, you can get this right now, patreon.com/Len, or you can go the old-fashioned route, which is lenperaltastore.com. You can order it. It arrives right in your mailbox or your digital mailbox, whatever you have. I'm also doing custom-drawn holiday cards, so you may want to consider those as well. But happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
There you happy go. Thanksgiving to you too, Len. And you as well, Patrick Norton. Let folks
Thank
know
you so much.
Where they can keep up with what you're up to.
Well, twitter.com/Patrick Norton until the Twitter apocalypse. What are we going to call it when it goes down? If it goes down, I hope it doesn't go down. Otherwise, avexcel.com is the best place to find me, or search for AVEXCEL on your favorite podcatcher. You can listen to Robert Herron and I talk about home theater and audio.
You don't want to miss it. Thanks to both of you for being with us today. Also, special thanks to Ariadne Specs, who is one of our top lifetime supporters for DTNS. Thank you for all the years of support, Ariadne. Woohoo! Speaking of patrons, stick around for our extended show, Good Day Internet. We roll into it right after DTNS wraps up. But just a reminder, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 2100 UTC. Find out more at dailytechnewsshow.com/live. And we hope you all have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday talking TV deals with Robert Herron. This week's episodes of Daily Tech News Show were created by the following people: host, producer, and writer Tom Merritt, host, producer, and writer Sarah Lane, executive producer and booker Roger Chang, producer, writer, and host Rich Stroffolino, video producer, Twitch producer Joe Kuntz, technical producer Anthony Lemos, Spanish language host, writer, and producer Dan Campos, news host, writer, and producer Jen Cutter, science correspondent Dr. Nikki Ackermans, social media producer and moderator Zoe Detterden, our mods Beatmaster, W. Scottis One, BioCow, Capt Kipper, Steve Guadarrama, Paul Reese, Matthew J. Stevens, J.D. Galloway, mod and hosting, video hosting by Dan Christensen, video feed by Sean Way, music and art provided by Martin Bell, Dan Luters, Mustafa A. Acast, and Len Peralta, live art performed by Len Peralta, Acast ad support from Tatiana Matias. Patreon support from Dylan Harari. Contributors for this week's show include Shannon Morse, Justin Robert Young, and Patrick Norton. Guests on this week's show included Trisha Hirschberger and Steve Saylor. Thanks to all our patrons who make this show possible.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.